everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the podcast, Lead Singer Syndrome. My name is Shane. I will be your host, as always, as I take you into the backstage conversations that I have with other lead singers. Yes, it's day 3,496 of quarantine. At least it feels like it. Man, 2 months, I guess it's been, right? 2 months, a little more. And yeah, I guess, you know, it's kind of crazy. I guess I've been pretty vocal on the show talking about how I wasn't doing so well. And, you know, quarantine isn't exactly for me. But I got to say, I'm starting to get used to it. And I don't know if that scares me or what. But like, you know, you're just kind of getting used to getting up, doing whatever. You know, it's kind of getting a little bit weird. And I feel a little too comfortable with it right now. But a month ago, I listened back to this. I did this about a month ago on April 24th. I recorded this with Mr. Dave Haas. He's our guest, by the way. And, you know, I think it was a whole different world a month ago, you know? It's incredible how fast things have been changing. But, you know, I planted the petunias. Now I'm moving on to some paver stones and a new walkway, smashing some concrete with a sledgehammer. That's what I'm up to lately. So yeah, I mean, that's a great way to take out your coronavirus frustration, I think. So that's the latest with me. But yes, Dave Haas, he's here. Great guy, a great guest, and what a talent, and what a story. This guy cut his teeth as a tech, as a roadie for other bands before giving it a shot on his own, and he's done very well for himself. And this really was a great conversation. I think there's so much here to take away. So sit back and get ready for a very excellent edition of the podcast. What are we at? Episode 225? I think we are. It's really, really nice. I really like that. Thank you for being here. As always, if you want to get in touch with me, you always can. You can email me, leadsingersyndrome@gmail.com. I read them all. Send them. Also, I'm on social media at Shane Told. The podcast is at Lead Singer Syndrome. Check us out on there. And I got to do the plug. I do it every week because it's important. The Lead Singer Syndrome All Access Club. It is what keeps this thing going week after week for free. Without it, I don't know where I would be. So yes, please, if you're a fan of the show, if you like this thing, if you listen week after week, or you just want to help me out, head over to leadsingersyndrome.com/all access. You pay a little money every month, and it's really, really nice for me. Really, it really is. It keeps it going. And you get a whole bunch of stuff for that little amount of money. You get bonus episodes, and we have a whole bunch lately. Interaction with me, tons of interaction with other fans of the show, an amazing, amazing community of like-minded music fans. Really, really great. And of course, access to Lead Singer Syndrome merchandise, free merchandise shipped to your house. It's really, really great. And it starts at as little as $6 a month. Maybe you've been saving some money during this quarantine. I don't know. I sure have been. What can you spend money on? Jeez, I've been buying some new equipment. That's about it. And paver stones and, you know, sledgehammers and all that. But, you know, it's kind of crazy. You know, I'm not making money, but I'm not really spending it either. So I don't know. Check it out. Again, the link is leadsingersyndrome.com/all access. Well, I guess that's about it. I don't have too much else to report. So let's get into it. And my conversation with Mr. Dave Haas.
I'm sick of feeling like I lost this fight. Sick of crying out the wrongs and rights. I'm pulling out of you to clear my sights. Tonight, alright, alright.
Come on.
Hi, Dave. What's up, man?
Hey, man. How you doing?
Pretty good. Pretty good. You know. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. We don't even have to, like, address it anymore, you know?
Well, yeah, it's weird. I mean, at some point, it's the cloud we're all under, and
yeah,
it's a sort of known commodity. But I suppose if we're recording this for future,
yes,
it would be good for reference to know that we are in the midst of COVID-19 pandemic.
Yeah, exactly. I've been really explicit with that. In fact, I've even been telling people the date, and today is April 24th. You know, just because shit changes so rapidly, you know.
Well, yeah, it is interesting because I think that, you know, point, we will be through this, and it's hard because if it's a solution, you know, if suddenly it's as passe, and I say that, you know, respect as any other disease we vaccinated for,
right,
won't be able to understand, I think, at least like in the very far off future, how severe this was. You know, obviously anybody living through it will remember how brutal this is. But, you know, if people are listening to this podcast in, like, you know, 15 or 20 years, they might go, what was everybody so worried about?
Hopefully that's the case, right? Hopefully it doesn't, like, change everything. So, you know, like, people will be like, remember when we used to shake hands? That was fucking weird. We were stupid for shaking hands. Like, I hope it doesn't turn into that kind of a world. But, you know, I mean, I think the longer this goes on, the more chance of that happening is, you know? And I think of, like, I mean, shit, we're from punk rock backgrounds and you know, you're still playing house shows when, or I mean, house shows are a bad example because we're talking about just, like, maybe 100 people or something. But, you know, like a packed club, like, think about the church in Philly when they sell that place out, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That amount of people in a small space, my fear is I don't want people to be like, I'm not fucking going there. Are you crazy? Because the longer this goes on, the more people are going to be worried of, if it isn't COVID-19, it'll be COVID-26 or COVID-48. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I'm trying not to go too far down any rabbit holes, but
right.
I do think that without a really sound cure or vaccine,
yeah,
I think our line of work is really going to change. And,
yeah,
you know, that's definitely another thing to put onto an otherwise very stressful situation. And so, you know, I think everybody's going through that. Anybody who has a job that is, you know, there's tons and tons of jobs in any sector.
Yeah.
They hinge on public interaction, you know? So
yeah.
I think, you know, for us, for what we do, the crazy thing too is I think the industry in general is just moving the goalposts. They keep going like, okay, well, let's reschedule for this date.
I know.
And I don't think, you know, I mean, I know that this is going to go out in public and I'll take the heat for it, but I just think that what they're doing is keeping themselves busy, and that's okay. But I don't think it's reasonable to assume we'll be back anytime soon without a very, very different way of handling the actual disease. Because, like you're saying, I mean, I wouldn't go to any show if you told me Eddie Vedder and Fiona Apple were playing a show down the block. I wouldn't go.
Right.
And, you know, otherwise I'd fall over myself to go to that gig and pay whatever I needed to get in. But I just would be like, yeah, I don't think so. It seems irresponsible and potentially dangerous. So
yeah
it's a scary time.
No, absolutely, man. I read a quote from an interview that you did in February. I'm going to read your words back to you here, but this is in February. Okay. Things look hopeless right now. The climate's a mess and democracy is in decline in the Western world and things look bleak. That's sort of where the record title came from. What do you mean? What do you do when you feel like drowning? Referring to your record kick. But it's just kind of, I laughed when I read that, right? Because when you did that interview, things were kind of fine compared to now, right? But like,
right,
it's a weird, it's not like a Band-Aid. It's a distraction, right, to everything else going on in the world. But here we are. You know, it's gotten even worse. And you know, where you are in your life now, obviously you're raising young children. everything has changed for you in just a couple of years. I can't imagine what's going through your head. It just must be such a whirlwind for you.
Well, here's the funny thing. I mean, I said that, and that was turning an outward eye. That was me watching the culture and, you know, being an American in the last couple of years. And trying to be aware of everything that's going on. But mm-hmm. personally, life was great.
Oh, okay. You know? Yeah.
I mean, I brought in to the world with my wife these two wonderful, you know, twin boys that have totally reset my, you know, value system and my hope. And you know, in terms of playing shows and the professional side of my life, like, it had been going great. You know, January and February, except for the last three shows getting canceled, were like yeah. some of the biggest and most successful shows that I had ever played as a solo headliner or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
And the year that we had planned out was very balanced. There was a lot of shows, but not too many. You know, it was just enough to kind of keep things going and allow enough room for family time and writing a new record. So I was sort of saying that more socially and politically. And now you're right. I mean, with a pandemic, I think like what you have is just another layer of pressure on an already strained world, an already strained economy and social structure and so on. And I think for me that this does the same thing personally. So at home, if there's, you know, things that you haven't worked out or divisions of labor or, you know, new ways of trying to navigate your life with children and so on,
right,
then a pandemic makes all that stuff more acute and difficult. So I think, you know, it's all, you know, in any kind of songwriting, I think like you're trying to do the macro and the micro. You're trying to do an overview mm-hmm. so that it can be understood more globally, and then also trying to get specific because that's where you infuse your own worldview on a song. And I think that's just happening right now for me with being home. And you know, it's funny. I'm sure you've gone through these weird waves too, where you're like, well, I mean, I don't have the virus.
Right.
My dad doesn't have the virus. My kids are okay. My wife's okay. You know, I'm not on my last $500, you know, like I can ride it out for a while. And so, you know, what do I really have to be worried about? And I think, but I think it's like that comparative suffering is probably not good. Like, it can be okay for you to be like, man, I'm bummed. I had all this good stuff going and right. I had a plan and now the plan is dashed, or I'm bummed. Hey, a lot of people are going to die, you know?
Sure, sure.
So yeah, you're right. There's a lot of thoughts flying around. And for me, that's been the daily difficulty is trying to get your mental health and that whole shooting match to jive and be in the moment. Because right now, we definitely don't know what's going to happen.
No. Well, I mean, you seem pretty positive and upbeat considering, you know, like I talked to Tim Berry, you know, Avail, Tim Berry, and it was a while ago, and he was, I mean, this is obviously why I put it in context. This was kind of right when things were happening, you know, and he's like, I got to stock up, you know, I got to get protein, all these things, right? And everybody handles this in different ways, but, you know, someone like Tim and someone like you in a lot of ways has some similarities, you know what I mean? He's got a kid too. You know, you guys both rely heavily on, you know, going out and performing live. I mean, that's got to be a huge bulk of your income. I mean, I don't even want to speculate on a percentage or whatever, but you know, when you're,
it's 85. Right. I mean, it's the same thing for everybody.
Yeah.
Anybody who does this, whether you're in the National or you're Bruce Springsteen or you're me or you're in Silverstein, like, it's 85%, maybe 90, mm-hmm. you know, of what we make. You go out and most of it is t-shirts.
Yeah.
You know, most of it is whatever you can make off the door once everyone's had their hand in the pot.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, and so I think the one thing for a guy like me or a guy like Tim is there's a scalable nature to what we do. And this was this was part of why I ended up playing solo in the first place, was because there was the crash of 2008 and 2009. And it rendered both of the businesses I had at the time kind of redundant. You know, I had a construction business and that all kind of closed down because nobody had money to build additions. And and that was sort of sustaining the fact that I was in a punk band at the time. And that was no longer, he couldn't make any margin on that either at the time because, you know, suddenly people didn't have money to go see the loved ones. So I said, well, I can go out and make as much or close to as much as a carpenter with just a guitar. And there's no carpentry work. And so if I just go in a car and with a box of t-shirts, I can kind of eke out a small living.
Right.
And that having, you know, this whole thing born out of that, I always go back to that. Like, I don't do the thing where, you know, I know that there's a big show in Philadelphia or Cologne or London, and that's going to pay for a week of the tour. I don't do that. Like, I make sure that we are as lean and mean as we possibly can be, because I know that the London show might not happen. And so, you know, it's sort of a depression mentality, but that's how I approach this. And so I can scale down and just go out in a car with my brother and play. And in that same respect, I can sort of, you know, go online and play one of these live streamed shows. As much as I don't necessarily want to do that in terms of like the aesthetic, I can. And I think that's one thing that, that can help. You know, when we go back to work, I can play maybe in people's houses or something. Like if there's a scalable version of playing live.
Right. So and I think and you've done it before, right? I mean, it's not going to be completely unfamiliar for you if that is, you know, something you have to do. It makes a lot of sense.
Right. I mean, all that said, I don't even see that happening for the foreseeable future. Like, I don't think we'll work in this 2020. And it's funny because we say that and then we go like, oh, maybe 2021, but it's not like the virus will go away by January 1st.
Yeah. So, no,
you know, it's really tricky, and I'm trying to figure out what to do because there's only so many times I think you can ask the fans to, you know, to tune in and hear the songs played on a Wi-Fi connection.
I know.
And there's only so many things you can offer, you know, like post here, like on my stage at show I did like a bunch of handwritten lyrics and a postcard that each person gets if the, you know, and that's cool, but I don't know. I mean, can you do that five times in a year? Maybe. But at a certain point, it's going to have to change. And so, and I'm kind of maybe to my own detriment, really hyper aware of that, you know, like I don't like to ask too much of people. I guess it's that same thing. Like I'm coming from a working class background and I know what it's like to have a really small budget for your entertainment. And, and so I'm really, you know, sensitive to that.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure, man. I mean, I think, you know, people are suggesting Patreon and these kinds of things where, you know, you offer exclusive content. And I mean, I'm up again. I don't judge any of this stuff, but it's just whether or not it's a fit for me, you know, like, so we'll see. I think it's definitely going to be time to come up with some new ideas. I mean, one idea is just to disappear. That was certainly something I come to, you know, two or three times a week. I go, well, maybe I'll just raise the kids. Cause my wife is a psychotherapist, you know, she's like, she's got work and she can work FaceTime or telehealth or whatever it is. And, you know, people are lining up for therapy right now.
Oh, and right.
So, you know, it may just be that we shift and try to get some, you know, support from, you know, music cares or whatever on one side of it. And then I can just raise my boys until I can go back to work with like any regularity.
Yeah.
But that doesn't really do my brother any favors. And
well, that's the thing. I mean, you know, with obviously the loved ones being such a great band, breaking up, your construction company kind of going away, and you embarking on this journey of Dave Haas, right? And that's, you're a solo act first and foremost. That's how people know you. But over time, and it's been, I guess it's been almost exactly 10 years since you've been putting out solo records, you know, but it's been a very slow and steady journey for you. You know, you've put out a lot of small releases and you pretty much played entirely by yourself, I guess, with your brother for, you know, is it 2017 when you kind of launched Dave Haas, you know, and the Mermaid and the whole, you know, the whole backing band. But I mean,
yeah, that was the third album.
The third album, yeah. I mean, but that's a big decision, right? I mean, I understand that that's probably why it took so long. Because once you do that, that's more mouths to feed. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That's more plane tickets. That's way more expenses to where you have to have higher guarantees. You have to be playing bigger places. It has to make sense. So, I mean, obviously, that I'm sure that was all by design, you know, but... that's a big step. And now you find yourself in this place where it's like, oh man, I'm for lack of a better word, you're their boss, right? I mean, you're their employment. So that's pressure.
Right. Exactly. I think at some point I had this conversation long before there was any, COVID, or it was basically when my wife got pregnant. I came to the band and we had done 150 shows in 2017, and I knew 18 was going to be a slower year.
Yeah.
And I approached everybody. I said, look, I don't have work for everybody. I've worked for Tim. And, you know, this has been awesome to do 150 or whatever it was. It was a ton of shows. Mm-hmm. But are you, you know, I'm concerned about you guys. And every one of them at the time, it was Kevin, Kaylee, and Miles were all like, you know, we didn't think we'd work this much. And we were always looking at this as like independent contractors. We weren't assuming we'd join Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. Like maybe someday, you know, but we knew what we were getting into.
Right.
And that was a big relief.
Sure.
Because, you know, yeah, you're right. I was worried. And even as Kick rolled out and we toured on that, I had the same conversation with Matt because our bass player, Miles, took a job at Hurley and you know, didn't want to be on the road anymore. But I think that you have to select people who understand what's going on and you have to be clear. There's a lot of, you know, friends of mine even that are band runners or whatever you call it, the... you know, solo guys that bring backing bands that aren't clear with their musicians. And it creates a lot of stress for people. And, you know, again, I think like part of the way that I try to handle that is twofold. One, I was a contractor, so I understand what it's like to be waiting for work and waiting for money.
Yeah.
And two, I was a roadie. So
right.
For years working for the Sick of It All and the Bouncing Souls and all those bands, like I knew what it was like to be reliant on others for work in this field. And so I try to be really clear with people who are going to play with me. Like, look, here's what I know. Here's what I don't know. You know, we're hoping to get fill in the blank tour with giant band, you know, X. If that doesn't happen, we've got this festival locked in. We've got the following dates. We're going to headline. That's what I've got. Would you like to do it? Right. And I do that like with people who are quote unquote in the band, like the public assumes they are in the band because that's who's playing. But I still try to approach it like, look, here's what I know. I'm going to let you know right away. And if you'd like to do it, great. If you can't, I totally understand, you know? So operating that way, at least people, you know, more than fame and fortune, I think people just want clarity.
Yeah.
You know, they just want to know when they're working, when they're not working, and so they can plan accordingly. And that's been something I try to keep at the top of my mind, because you are asking other people to play your songs. You know, at the end of the day, I'm sort of responsible for that, and I try to honor that with, you know, with the dignity of communication.
Well, that's important. I think that's really noble of you to do that, because a lot of people, unfortunately, and this is Lead Singer Syndrome, the name of the podcast. It's obviously tongue in cheek, but there are a lot of pricks out there. I mean, there's a lot of people that are way too good for the other members of their band, and you know, they treat them I don't want to say like slaves, that's bad terminology, but you know, in some ways, oh, what, you don't want to drive around for 3 weeks in a van? I get my own bench seat. There's four of you on one bench seat, you know, and here's $50. You know what I mean? That's
yeah,
that's right. The reality that a lot of this, a lot that happens in, I'm not going to say our world, but in music, you know, it does happen.
Oh, I think it happens a lot, you know, in the larger music industry, but it certainly happens in a more subtle way in our world. Mm-hmm. It just has to do with your ego and whether or not you have that in check or you've ever even thought about it in the first place. And, you know, a lot of the ways that I try to operate now are born of making errors in the past.
Right.
Like I would take full responsibility for, you know, my role in the loved ones being a dysfunctional situation. And, you know, was guilty of lead singer syndrome in certain aspects back then.
Yeah.
And instead of saying, hey, you know, whatever gifts you were given that really don't have much to do with you. In other words, like if you're able to work a crowd and you have a voice where you can sing relatively close to being in key, or you can write lyrics that compel people, like you didn't have much to do with that gift. It's like being born a super attractive person, you know, like, I don't know what that's like, but it does. I have spent time with people who that's all they've got going and they're not that compelling because they're basically trading on a currency of something they were given, not something they worked for. But anyway,
right.
If you have those gifts, you really should be, you know, thanking your lucky stars that you're not digging a ditch. And, you know, for a living, because in other times in our species, you would have been the jester. You know what I mean? Like if you didn't entertain the king, you didn't eat and maybe you lost your head, but it's just in the last couple hundred years or even 100 years that you can sing and be in a band and have that like, be venerated to the, you know, oh my God, that person's, you know, special.
Right. Well, so you think that, you know, being able to sing or write or whatever is, you think that that's kind of something you're born with, not something that, you know, people work towards as much? Like, what's your take?
I do think it's a little bit of each, uh-huh. But you could, most of what I do is working hard at it. You know, like I don't, but what I mean is like that, the little spark wherein you can, you know, there's certain people that can work a crowd and certain people that can't.
Right.
And that little spark, you're, you know, that sort of, you can work at it, you can get better at it. But what I mean is like being flippant with something that you were given. You
right.
know, being
for sure. I understand your point. I just was analyzing that one thing you said, and I was like, huh, that, I don't know if that's something we'd ever really talked about on the podcast before. So that's why I kind of gravitated towards that for a second, you know?
Well, you know, I mean, the longer I go in this business, the people who, and especially since I've been sober, the people who go on and on and on about, you know, why they are great at what they do or how they're great at what they do, it's just a drag. You know, you're just, it becomes like, man, this person is totally self-absorbed. And I think that a lot of that is an enemy of songwriting. You know, like I think a lot of what you want is to have your antennae up so that you can receive transmissions. You know, you can receive ideas that are like sort of in the greater consciousness and so on. And empathy is a huge part of that. And I think if you're totally wrapped up in your own ego, a lot of that turns off.
Yeah.
Especially over time. So I don't know. I think it's interesting because lead singer syndrome, I figured it was tongue in cheek, obviously, because we've met and I don't get that from you at all. And, you know, but it is a thing that creeps in when you're especially early on, when you first go from like, you know, whatever it might be, a barista or working at a movie theater or hanging drywall to like, having a successful show, that's a huge responsibility to suddenly realize like this song you made up in your underwear, with the TV on.
that's how I write. Yeah.
Right. You know, and when that happens, if you're too young or you're too drunk or you're too immature to handle that, you can really make a mess of it.
Yeah.
And
you think you did. Do you think you did with the loved ones? I mean, the loved ones, let's go back and talk about that band. You know, you mentioned that you were you said roadie. Are you allowed to say roadie? Is that a derogatory term? Or if you were one, you can say it.
I don't know. I didn't think of it as derogatory, but again, this is the it's a changing time. Everything's changing. So
I know.
If it's derogatory in 2020, then I'm sorry. But no, I think
I don't
it
know.
Just means you work as I was a stage tech, to be more specific.
Right. Yes. No, I always hear people say that they're that or a crew member or whatever. I feel like, I don't know if roadie is a bad word these days, but regardless, if you were one, you take back that word, Dave, you're good. But you know, you came from that. You knew, kind of the ins and outs of what a headliner band was entitled to, you know, when you headlined, for example, like a lot of bands, you know, when they start touring and stuff, they don't get it. They don't know the etiquette, you know, maybe, right. Oh, like catering's up. Well, like maybe wait till the headliners get their first take of the catering, you know, not that anyone even does that anymore, but you know, those kinds of things, you know, you were very in tune with. So then you start this band. Great. I mean, I love the loved ones so much. Still,
oh,
like, I still love your records and I'm so sad that the band went away, but you know, you got a lot of people saying how great you are. And you're getting some pretty good tours, but then at the same time, the success from the band wasn't like immediate. It wasn't like, oh, well, here we are at the church in Philly. Next time we're going to be at the truck. And next time we're going to be at Electric Factory. You know, it wasn't that kind of momentum that the band had. So just take me through kind of the ins and outs of the how you started and then, you know, kind of what happened. Because it wasn't that many years.
Oh, no, it wasn't. That's why it's so funny to have it come up so often.
Yeah.
Especially now, because most places where I play, like, we can draw as many or more people than the loved ones. A lot of people don't even know who the loved ones were.
Yeah.
You know, just because I've been at this now for 10 years, and I think the loved ones all in was maybe 5 years, and maybe 3.5 of those were super active.
Yeah.
But a lot of it was, we just came right out of the gate swinging, and I think we were – so there was this band, The Curse, that I did.
Yeah.
I was doing a band called The Curse and a band, Painted Black. I was in with Dan Eman and Andy Nelson and stuff. And so it sort of came out of a scene, and The Curse did one full year, and we got amazing shows. I mean, we were able to open for Sick of It All and Avail, and we did a whole tour with Avail. We opened for Fugazi. I mean, it was crazy.
Wow.
And that was 2003, and I was also working for the Bouncing Souls then, pretty much full time. So I was going back and forth between Souls work, working for the Explosion, and they were on Virgin at the time, so they were getting all these big tours, and you know, I was really busy. But The Curse caved in. We got sued for the name by a band with like 40 MySpace fans or something, but they just happened to have a bass player that was a lawyer.
Oh, so really?
So they sued for the name, and right when our EP was coming out, and we just kind of folded up the tent. And I realized
the Curse. Wait, so there was another band called The Curse that sued you?
Yeah, that's right.
Not
yeah,
Cursed. I thought you meant Cursed, like the band from Canada.
Oh no!
I was like, that does not sound like Chris Callahan, too.
No. There's another band called The Curse.
Right. Okay. Got it.
And their bass player happened to be a lawyer, so the ability to sue, and we were sort of just wet behind the ears and went, oh my God, a lawsuit, we gotta quit.
Yeah.
And so anyway, that band caved in, and that band was really hardcore. We were sort of playing really genre specific music, you know, and I realized that I didn't want to do that. That a lot of my influences were more rock, you know, more rock and roll and classic music and so on. And I just wanted to get away from that. And I wanted to sing. I wanted to be the only vocalist or whatever, the only songwriting. I wanted a clear, like a clear artistic means to deliver. And
Were you pretty confident as a singer at that point? Like, did you feel like, hey, I can do this? Or were you like, I'm going to try?
Not exactly. Exactly. Like, I didn't really know how to sing in the studio, and I really didn't. I mean, what was Hot Water Music and the Bounce toured a lot together.
Hot Water Music? Yeah. Cut out for a second. Hot Water Music and the Bouncing Souls? Is that what you said?
Yeah. When I was working for the Souls, Hot Water toured with them a bunch. And I had been good friends with the Hot Water guys for whatever, you know, just through punk music scene and all that jazz. Yeah. And I think at the time Waller didn't want to be playing Trusty Chords. Like, he was like, oh, I don't want to play that song. It's too simple. Or I forget what, somebody just reminded me that this is the way it went down. And I didn't even remember this, we all, the Souls and I, were all like, what? That's the best song. And so I think we started playing it in soundcheck, and Waller was tickled by the version. I was like, well, why don't you sing it? And that put an enormous amount of confidence into an otherwise kind of uncertain person. You know, I had sang in the Curse backups, and I sang all the melody parts.
Yeah.
Our singer at the time was more of like a hardcore singer. And so I had, like, you know, the B parts. And so I had a little bit of confidence that way, but not as like a lead vocalist. But honestly, as crazy as it sounds, like, being able to perform one song with, you know, that was written by one of my favorite songwriters, and having that songwriter go like, you sound great, you should do this with us on tour.
So you played. So wait. So the Souls played Trusty Chords with you?
Yeah.
At shows?
Yep.
Because, well, Hot Water wasn't playing.
Oh,
yeah, but then it actually happened, yeah.
Yeah, and then I think it may have been one of those things where, like, at the end, the bands all kind of came out and played each other's songs or something.
Right.
And Waller would be like, you sing two verses or I can't remember, because it was so drunk. The whole thing was so, you know, it was a long time ago, and it was very lubed by booze.
Right.
But I do remember that being a huge confidence booster. And every band that I worked for, like the Explosion, the Souls, even Sick of It All, were like, I don't know that you should be doing this. Like, they would hear me play guitar or something, or like strumming on a song, and they'd be like, what is that? I'm like, oh, that's a song I made up. And they'd be like, why aren't you, really should not tune our guitars. Which is, again, that's a big boost for somebody who, I had no clear idea of a musical life. You know, like, Philadelphia at the time, there was a hardcore scene, but there wasn't anybody that I knew that made a living playing music. Like, that was so foreign to me. So working for Sick of It All, working for the Bouncing Souls, like, you sort of figure out how that works.
Right.
And then to have those people who were, at that point, the only example I had of people who make a living playing music say, hey, you could do it too. That's pretty enormous at a, you know, in your 20s, to have people like that say, because it was not lost on me that I was working for two of, like, the biggest underground punk bands at the time. You know, like, they were huge. So those votes of confidence, I think, had a lot to do with me being willing. And over time, the guys in the Souls and the guys in Hot Water helped. You know, I had, like, band names planned for the loved ones that like Chris Wallard or Pete Steinkopf from the Souls would be like, that's not the right name. That's too dark. Like,
right.
You have to make this about who, you know, your best nature. And, you know, so those are major impactful things to say to somebody who's just starting. And then our first show was the Bouncing Souls, Hot Water Music, and Gray Area at the Trocadero in Philly.
Oh man, I love Gray Area. What a great band.
Yeah, so that
was so under the radar. I like love Gray Area.
They were great. Yeah. And Ernie was.
I never saw them play. I don't know if they ever came to Canada, but
probably not.
I don't know. I never saw them. So.
Queens, let alone go to Canada. So, but yeah. So that, then the band was off to the races, and you know, it's funny because you say that it wasn't. It wasn't a. you know, we were immediately playing the truck, but our first show was actually at the truck. And then surprisingly, we had like all of anybody within the bubble of people that I knew, which was like J Tree Records, Fat Records, Epitaph, Side One, like they all were interested right away. And so in some ways, there was a lot of heat right off the bat, like off that first P, people were at least interested. And we started to see the shows fill pretty quick, especially like in Philly and New York. Like we started to go from 50 people to 200 or 500 or, you know. And then it got weird because I think between the first, between the two records, there was, you know, basically the internet really took over in terms of like the way people was, were receiving music.
Well, yeah, this is like prime MySpace days, you know?
Right. This was, the first record was 06. The second record was 08. It's funny. I read like a piece. It was maybe like in, I don't know, it was some music publication that said like, those are the forgotten years. Those are the years where, you know, CDs no longer exist and streaming wasn't really up. So it's really easy to basically forget what even happened. Like, we don't really have a record of what happened then, which I think is interesting because we both were very, very busy making music then.
Yes, like as busy as ever. Like, that, that's funny because that's, I've never heard anyone say it for those years specifically, but I think to that and I go, oh, okay, that was my prime. My prime was the forgotten years. Hey, great, great. Anyway,
I know. I sort of felt the same. I felt a certain amount of like sadness about that because I was like, yeah, they, it makes sense because what they were saying was in 2001 and two, records were still selling like crazy, you know, or even three.
Yeah.
You had like AFI make a platinum album or whatever.
Right,
and,
right.
But then it sort of fell off, and that's when we got busy. So, yeah, it's great. It's anyway, so the band just – and I think we made a really good first album. Like, I think that people responded, and Fat was really on board. They were really excited. It was before a lot of the internal struggles came for them, that first record.
Right. Well, I remember talking to Fat Mike about the record. And I think this was because it was, I think it was Warped Tour, maybe. No, yeah, it must have been Warped Tour. And we used to play poker like almost every night on Warped Tour. And I think this would have been 06. And I remember something came out. I think Billy was wearing a Loved Ones shirt. I think that that's what it was. And and Fat Mike was like, he said something like, you know how, you know Mike. He said something like really crazy, like really, you know, like, that's the best record I ever put out. He's like, but they got the sequence all wrong. He's like, the sequence, all the best songs are at the end of the record, and I told him it's a great record, but it's in the wrong order. And
he called. There's a really good story about that. He called
really?
Me.
Oh, I want to hear it. I want to hear it so bad.
So one of the reasons this is so much of this is kind of still couched in a little bit of shame for me because I feel like there were some errors made, but we went out and opened for NoFX in San Francisco and then went right down to LA and played two shows with Bad Religion, like in the same weekend.
Yep.
And that was essentially showcases. Like, both Brett and Mike wanted to see what this band was about. And basically Mike, I already knew NoFX and I knew Bad Religion a little bit, but I was comfortable with Mike because the Souls and Sick of It All had both toured so much with him.
Yeah.
And he walked into the backstage and handed me a bag of drugs and was like, look, I'll pay for the demos. If I like them, I'll put it out. That's my pitch. And I was like, wow, this is so easy. Great. And we had a great night. And then I went down to Los Angeles with the band and it was tough. The Bad Religion crowd was not feeling it.
Right.
And I was getting heckled and I made a joke wherein I said, okay, I get it. You don't like us, but I'm not the idiot that paid $36.50 to come see Bad Religion. To the heckler. Which was, you know, I know Jay and I know Brian and I knew they would think that was funny.
Right.
But it didn't necessarily ingratiate us towards anyone in the 1,000 capacity place.
Right.
So right off the bat, I think Brett was kind of like, what is up with this guy? And then we talked about putting out the record, and Brett had a really interesting way of looking at it. He was like, you know, you don't really have time to develop. You have to put out your best record first. Are you ready to do that? And I was like, whoa, that's a lot of pressure.
Right.
Maybe we'll just do this thing with Mike. Because at the time, it just seemed like the same label to me. Like, I didn't know that much about Epitaph or Fat, other than they both seemed to be these, like, juggernauts. And yeah. So I went with Mike.
Except it's the one juggernaut has like a bunch of platinum records, I think is the difference.
Well, right. And some of that I did know, and some of that I didn't realize would still keep going. Nobody knew what would happen either. So I just was like, you know what? It's more comfortable with Mike. And frankly, like, we would have done better with Brett. Brett is very focused. Yeah. He's not on drugs. He's
not anymore. Yeah.
Clear. Well, not even then, you know.
No, I know. Not even then.
In retrospect, I should have taken the challenge and met Brett where he was and listened to an amazing, you know, incredible songwriter and business person who is thinking about investing in my band. But instead, I did something that was comfortable.
Yep.
And maybe, you know, and you know, there's drugs and booze involved too. So at any rate. At any rate, we make the record. Mike loves the demos. And he calls me when I sent the master in. He's in Japan. And he goes, hey, you got the sequence all wrong. And I said, what? And he goes, yeah, I think you need to put 100K first, and you need to do this, and you need to do that. And he had resequenced it, at least to some degree. And I went, okay, well, what's it worth to you? And he goes, what do you mean? I was like, I mean, is it worth $5,000 or $10,000 or... $20,000, like what do you got? And there was this long pause. He was like, you gotta be kidding me. And I was like, dude, I didn't sign to an independent record label to have the boss call me and tell me how to make the album. Like, I signed to Fat so we could do whatever we wanted. So I'm willing to change it, but you gotta pay me.
Wow.
And he laughed, and he was kind of annoyed, you know. He was like, you gotta be shitting me. And I was like, well, you got to be shitting me. I want creative control.
Right.
And he goes, all right, well, it's your record. Do whatever you want then. I got to go. And he was annoyed. And I thought it was, you know, sort of an act of artistic bravery or whatever you want. I just was like, no, you're not going to tell me how to sequence the record. But I think you can sense a pattern developing here. Like, you've got a young, you know, fairly new to the game idiot who's telling these, you know, Brett Gurewitz and telling Fat Mike, like, no, I'm going to do what I want to do. And I think that's fine if you know what you're doing. And I'm just not so sure when I look back, I did know what I was doing.
Well, talking about the sequence, 100K first, that's interesting. I wouldn't have probably grabbed that, you know. 100K is like the second last track, is that right?
I think it's somewhere
near the end. Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you like looking back, and obviously Fat Mike has made a lot of records and he knows he's an amazing songwriter. Do you think that he was right? Like, if you look back and think about what he said, are you like, maybe he was right? Do you think it would have mattered?
Not on that. No, actually, because that was such a close record to my heart. Like, I had written that record about losing my mom and it was supposed to go in a certain order. And,
right.
You know, I wasn't looking at the record as, let's put our at the time, I just thought, well, we put out an EP and 100K started that, and we're already yielding by putting it on the record anyway. Like, we already put this out. Our fans already know it. Little did I realize there was like 5,000 fans at the time.
Of course.
Nobody had heard 100K. Like, so I don't know. He may have been right commercially, but I mean, that's such a, that record was so, it was so specific to an emotional state I was in that I didn't really want it messed with. Brett, on the other hand, I think he was right. I think that's a situation where I should have listened and should have been more receptive and strategic. You know, like, I should have been like, wow, this guy runs the biggest and most successful independent label in history. and he wants to put out my record, maybe I should give him a listen.
Right.
And so I do have a regret about that.
Yeah.
Because generally speaking, like if you look at that band, had we kept going, most of it is keeping going, right? Like if we had just gone and made a third album and that record would have been devoured, that my second solo record, that's most of the songs.
Yeah.
The band would have continued to be successful and we'd still, you know, we would have had a shot at least.
Yeah.
So it, you know, there's regret with any breakup or any slowdown. I just think like
Go ahead. Sorry, I'll finish. Let you
well,
finish.
I just think at the end of the day, though, it did bring me to this chapter. And you know, when we did those loved ones 10-year anniversary of Keep Your Heart shows, the one of the takeaways is as much as I was psyched to do them and psyched by the response, I was really psyched to be done with them. Because what I'm doing now, especially with regard to like playing with my brother and being able to play, you know, in a seated theater or a church or something and a rock club and a festival is a lot more suited to what I like to do. So,
Absolutely. You
know, in the end, I'm happy I don't do that anymore. But when you look back and go like, wow, what could have been?
Right.
You realize some of the missteps.
Well, what happened with the band anyway? Because it seemed like you never, like, there was never any clarity, at least for me as a fan, of what happened. It was just like, oh, well, the band isn't doing anything anymore. And now Dave's, I guess, doing solo stuff. But there was a period of time there where it, you know, I don't think you guys ever played like a final show or you never made an announcement or anything, unless I missed it, you know, of kind of what happened.
No, we just kept delaying that sort of statement. And to some degree, we still have, you know, the band isn't broken up. If there was a reason to play, we'd do it. It seemed more and more ridiculous as time went on to break up the band because, you know, no one had stolen someone's lover or stolen money or, you know, I love those guys. And the feeling I hope is mutual. And, you know, we're like brothers. And so there was no real reason to break up other than everyone was burnt out.
Yeah.
You had guys in their early 30s. Almost everybody was either married or getting divorces or whatever it was. Like we were all in that period. And there just wasn't a lot of money.
Yeah.
And so when I came to them with the Devour songs, they were like, well, these are your best songs to date. And we should make this album as a band. Because at that point, I had made one solo record. And I figured I'd go back and, you know, this is my big statement. This should be done with a band. And pretty much all of them were like, well, let's put this out and see what happens. Like, we don't want to commit to a lot of touring.
Right.
And I was like, oh, that, I'll tell you what's going to happen if we put this out and don't tour. Like, nothing.
Yeah, and then you're shooting yourself in the foot too, because then what? You're going to go on tour as Dave Haas playing loved ones songs, and that, you know, that,
yeah, it was, it
even
was
though they're
really
your songs, yeah, it's right, yeah, yeah.
And I shouldn't say this, but the other thing was because money was in such short supply, there was kind of everyone was kind of like, well, we want to share the publishing too, and I was like, but I wrote all these songs,
right?
So there was that argument, which again is amongst friends, which almost makes it harder when you're dealing with in a situation that doesn't feel equitable, but you love these people and they're your best buddies. It really creates a hard squeeze.
Yeah, that is tough.
So, yeah. And at that point I had done the revival tour over in Europe. I was starting to sell out my own shows over there. And, you know, I had an offer to go back with Alkaline Trio and Gaslight Anthem and, you know, it was starting to really cook solo. Like people liked Resolutions. And I just sort of saw it as a crossroads and I was like, well, then forget it. I'm just going to make this album on my own. I got management at the time, you know, I had Social Distortions management. And they were like, look, you know, let's go. What loved ones? Well, who? You know?
Yeah.
So there started to be this really clear idea that I could, make a living as a musician if I just squared up and did it. And those guys all sort of were like, well, then go do it. You know, I think two of them.
That's great. You had their blessing too to do it. I mean, that gives you some confidence as well, right? You know?
Yeah, to a degree. I mean, it was also a little bit of that feeling I had as a roadie where I was like, are you guys trying to fire me? It's like, am I not doing a good job as a roadie, and that's why you're telling me to go work? Or, you know, and almost that was the thing with the loved ones. I was like, well, if you guys are saying you back this, why wouldn't you want to do it? So it was confusing. It was really confusing. But my personal life at the time started to collapse as well. I was separating from my ex-wife, and I just was like, you know, the leanest and meanest I can be is just out on the road. Like, I can just play these songs with the guitar. I can do my thing and not be worried about all this stuff. Like you were even saying at the beginning of the podcast, where it was like, you know, what about feeling responsible for your band? And, you know, yeah. Like, I was like, I don't have to be responsible for anyone, including myself, because as long as there was a bottle of whiskey backstage,
right,
I was fine, you know, and another show to go to.
How long have you been sober?
I got sober in 2015.
So 5 years, just about.
It's about to be 5 years in the summertime.
How's that ride been for you? I mean, obviously, at your age, if you're 42 now, mm-hmm. basically you had your birthday, your 42nd birthday, and then the world completely took a shit, right?
Like, man, on your birthday? It was the morning of my birthday where we canceled Boston, Baltimore, and Philadelphia.
Oh man, yeah, happy birthday, Dave. But you know, at age, you know, you go sober at age 37, your late 30s, you've been touring for a long time at that point. You know, the bottle of whiskey backstage, that's kind of something that's always there. That, you know, yeah. that in obviously if you went sober, then you relied on that. Was that really hard to just give it up? And how has it been now, obviously transitioning into finding different things to, I guess, do? For lack of a better word.
Well, I think that's a good question. Because it was really hard. And it sort of feels like voting in America. It's the lesser of two evils. Hmm. I don't want to be sober. You know, like it's not a comfortable situation to always be in. But I certainly don't want to go back to being drunk and on drugs. And I think part of that is maybe just like, you know, stopping doing it is one thing, but recovering is another. And I think, like, I'm still in that process, frankly, after all these years, like, finally dealing with it in therapy and stuff like that. And, you know, trying to determine why you did what you did, why you're an addict, et cetera, et cetera. That was slow for me, and it's still slow for me. I don't have it all worked out. But I definitely think I'm better at being a human being than I was. And I think, as bumpy as it is, and as difficult as it's been at different times, I can keep my head held a little bit higher than I used to. You know, I'm a better brother. I'm better at being a husband. And certainly I would not have been prepared to be a dad of twins if I was still boozing and drugging. I just think it's like, it's a crutch that was useful for a while that's no longer useful. So I'm happy to be rid of it. It's just sometimes hard to walk.
Well, congratulations, man, on that. That's great.
Thanks.
And I think your last record is your best work. So, you know, thanks. Sober mind, can make some incredible art. You know, a lot of people think drugs or drinking helps. You know, I remember Frank Turner telling me, fuck that. I never wrote anything good when I was drunk or on drugs. You know, and when he said that, I was like, Frank Turner? I was like, that's a guy known for, like, you know, you picture Frank Turner, you know, his, I mean, I know we both know him, but his vibe, what he gives off is like, oh, Frank's drunk with an acoustic guitar sitting around the fire. You know what I mean? And he's an amazing, amazing songwriter, singer about these stories. And he said that, and I was like, damn, like, if a guy like that doesn't need drugs or alcohol to write, that says something, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think it's a, I don't, I think he's right about that. And I think, it was interesting because after getting sober, I read two of the most pivotal, rock books that I've read. One was the Replacements book and one was the Springsteen book.
Yeah.
And to some degree, like the Loved Ones, or then even what I do solo, you could kind of cross those two and you get what I'm trying to go for, the Replacements and Bruce Springsteen.
Sure.
But the one thing that I sort of realized was that, you know, the way that Paul Westerberg operated his band, and what I romanticized about that really got in my way. You know, it really wasn't the best way to operate. It wasn't the best way to like bring fans in or perform, you know, that sort of drunken circus clown vibe. Right. You know, the lyrics are much more geared towards like a Springsteen thing, a redemptive thing. Like that's where I'm at my best, I think, is when I'm reaching for that. And so to operate any part of my persona, or whatever you want to call it, like the thing you shine out to the world as more of a drunken clown that's confusing the audience was not the way to go. And so it was interesting to read those two books back to back and be like, damn it, I wish I would have reached more towards Springsteen and less towards Westerberg when it counted, you know, when back then, when it was like, you know, when I had that option. And now I guess I do have that option. Sure. And I try to reach more towards the light, you know, like it's not my bent. I mean, I even like walked back a tweet yesterday and you know, I put something up that was something to the effect of like, let's have a live stream wherein like CEOs and Wall Street types have to give money to the poor. And if they don't, we can light them on fire. And it was funny and people, you know, liked it or whatever. But I realized like, yeah, but you're playing to your base nature.
Right.
And you're playing to like negative vibes. And I'm, you know, I'm comfortable there. But that's not really what this whole thing is about for me, you know, long term, especially now with like children and I have younger siblings and stuff. And they're all through their husbands and they have hard jobs and, you know, to kind of be flippant and negative.
Right.
Especially now, it just feels irresponsible, you know? So I think like those are some of the lessons that I've learned over time. You know, and unfortunately those lessons were kind of learned in public.
Live and learn. It's the oldest cliche in the book, but it's, I mean, there's nothing truer. So, hey,
right.
You know,
exactly.
here we are, April 24th, 2020. And, you know, who knows where we're going to go. I mean, well, dude, thanks for doing this. Anything else to tell the people before I let you go? I know we've been talking for almost an hour.
Well, just I guess the easiest thing is if you're not familiar with what I do or where I do it, it's all up online at Dave Haas. That's HAUSE.com or Twitter is Haas Dave. Instagram is Dave Haas. So some iteration of that is how you'll find what I'm up to. And I guess what we're all up to is in question right now.
Yeah.
Hoping, we can safely do what we do best as soon as possible. But, I right now I'm just trying to, I guess my boys will be up in another hour from nap, and that's my first thing I got to do.
There
and beyond
go.
That, I'm uncertain of what the world's going to bring. But
there
thanks
go.
So much for having me on, man.
Of course.
I really appreciate it.
Oh, of course. Thank you. Thank you for doing it and, you know, speaking so openly and honestly, and all the best, man, with everything, with the family, hopefully with figuring out, you know, what you're going to do with music and everything else. And I hope you're writing. I hope you're writing some stuff.
Starting to, yeah.
Good.
Yeah, for
good.
Sure. I mean, definitely trying to steal a few minutes a day away for a couple lines at a time, you know.
Great.
So,
well, I'd love, yeah, can't wait to hear it.
Stay healthy and, you know, all the best trying to figure out how to get music to people and exist on that. You know, we're in the same boat in that respect.
Absolutely.
So,
well, Dave,
come up with anything. Shoot me a text.
I will do, man. Yeah, we're all bored over here. Just shit. Yeah, whatever, man. It's all good. Hit me up. Dave, thank you so much, man. All the best. And I'm going to play a tune for the people. Do you have a favorite solo track or maybe a deep cut that, you know, maybe doesn't get that much love?
Yeah, maybe Weather Vane off the new record would be fun.
All right. Cool.
It's a kind of a look inside my brain.
Let's do it. Weather Vane. Here it is on Lead Singer Syndrome. Thank you, Dave.
Thanks. No one made it out alive. It's a paranoid.
spends her whole life believing in little white lies. Have we been unkind? Got a storm of trouble on my mind tonight. I'm spinning in the middle of a hurricane, spinning like a weather vane now. It's retirement spent on replacement needs. It's you without me. It's life on a screen. It's the copay down at the pharmacy. It's a satellite with its eyes on me. Have we been unkind? I've got this storm of trouble on my mind tonight. I'm spinning.
Music from Dave Haas. I want to thank Dave so much for taking the time out of his, I'm sure, very busy schedule to speak with me. Make sure you go check out all of Dave's solo stuff. And when you're done that, go back and listen to The Loved Ones, a great band that maybe fell through the cracks just a little bit. Hey, it turns out, you know, a lot of people right now really don't have a lot going on and they want to talk to me. And I have so many great episodes of the show coming up. So make sure that you're subscribed on whatever you're listening to this on. And make sure you tune in next week for another doozy of an episode. Check out the Lead Singer Syndrome All Access Club. And if you've got any tips about how to smash concrete faster than the way I'm doing it, let me know. Yes, I know there's a jackhammer. I'm old school, man. I got a sledgehammer. I'm smashing it. It takes out the rage. It's good. But yes, I'm sure there's some professional landscapers right now. It's prime time season for you. So I'm just a lowly amateur. Anyway, thanks again so much for being here and tuning in. And I will see you all next week. Peace and love.